The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled The Brilliance of Tiberius, The Life and Times of Rabbi Yochanan and the Yeshiva of Tiberius, Tiberia, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas Rabbi Avram David ben Rabbi Eliyahu Olav HaSholem, Rabbi Avram David Dalfin of blessed memory.
One of the most basic themes in Judaism is the connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. Three times every day we stand in prayer and plead for the ingathering of the exiles, the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple, Beis HaMikdash, and the restoration of spiritual life in the land of our forefathers. Our connection with the land of Israel, however, is not merely based on our dreams and longing for the glorious future that awaits us in the days of Mashiach. Despite the mass destruction and foreign despotic rule that has been its lot for over 2,000 years, Eretz Yisrael has continued to hold a special attraction for countless courageous souls who have braved its physical perils in order to reap its spiritual benefits. In a sense, even in its desolation, there's no place on earth like the land of Israel. The Talmud in Kedushin, Mem Tes Amud Beis, in 49b, teaches us that the ten portions of wisdom, Asorah Kavim, came down to the world. Nine was taken by the land of Israel. According to the Gemara in Bava Basra and Kufnun Ches Amud Beis in 158b, just breathing the air in Israel imparts wisdom. In the words of the Medrash Rabbah, this is in Brachos, this is chapter 16, this is section 4. Ein Torah k'Torahs Eretz Yisrael, v'lo chochma k'chochmas Eretz Yisrael. There's no Torah like the Torah that's learned in the land of Israel, and there's no wisdom like the wisdom that's imparted by being in Eretz Yisrael. The wisdom of the land of Israel, however, is not available just for those who have lived on its soil or breathed its air. To a large degree, we can all access the Torah and the wisdom of Eretz Yisrael. This is the Torah of Israel and the Chochmah of Israel has been preserved for us in the form of the Mishnah and the Talmud. Virtually every page of the Talmud Bavli, the Talmud that was composed in Babylon over 1,500 years ago, is full of the wisdom of the sages of Israel. The Talmud Yerushalmi, that Talmud that was composed in the land of Israel well over 1,600 years ago, is actually a syllabus of the curriculum that was studied in the yeshivas in Israel during the 3rd and 4th century of the Common Era. Until persecution by the Romans and the Christian Church made it impossible to continue, those yeshivas were a major source of enlightenment and inspiration for all of Jewry. Of all the great personalities in Israel in the 3rd and 4th centuries, one towering individual above all is associated with the flourishing of Talmudic study in general and the Talmud Yerushalmi in particular. His name is Rabbi Yochanan. His story and the yeshiva he created is the topic of tonight's lecture. Before we're beginning, I would just like to present a brief summary of what the Talmud actually is. The original Torah that was imparted to Moshe and to the Jewish people consisted of two parts. One, the written Torah, the one that we have in the scroll, this is in all our synagogues. And the other is the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law. The relationship between the written law and oral law is perhaps best described as the relationship of a college lecture and the notes that a student has to take while listening to the lecture. The notes have to be, especially if the student is writing in English, has to be very brief, concise, and perhaps written in a style that the student, after looking at the notes, could reconstruct the whole lecture. However, someone who is not privy to the style of the note taker, looking at the notes, sees relatively very little. The Torah shebiksav, the written law, are the notes. The Torah shebal peh, the oral Torah, is the entire lecture. That lecture, though, is itself divided into two parts. One part is the Mishnah. The original Mishnah, and this seems from works in the times of the Gaonim and from the Talmud, consisted of 600 or 700 orders. The Mishnah that we have today consists of 6 orders. And it was a work that consisted of 600. Evidently it was very detailed, very large. That work was condensed into the work that we have now during the end of the Second Temple period under the auspices of the Yeshiva of Hillel and Shammai. So that's the Mishnah, which is the originally the totality of the oral law and now really a summary, an outline of the oral law. The second section is the Talmud. The Talmud is the reasoning. And it again consists of two parts. One is, how do I connect the vast oral tradition to the written text? Where is it hinted at? The other is the logic itself. How does it make sense? What's it based on? What are the underlying principles, and what can I derive from these laws to see the overall picture? Just as a physicist will look at the physical laws of nature and derive underlying principles, so too the Talmudic scholar will look at this whole mass of information and try to find what would be the underlying principles that govern this body of knowledge. Basically, instead of the laws of not physics but metaphysics. That is the Talmud. And the Talmud existed even in the time of Moshe. Even in the original time, there was the study of Talmud. The Talmud that we have today is the analysis of the Mishnah, as the original text, of the oral law, and it's the understanding of its underlying principles. And because we said this is an abbreviated form, as this is originally, it was a much larger work, much of the Talmud is devoted to uncovering or bringing in tangential information that, although not included in the Mishnah, was still part of Jewish tradition. So here in the work of the Talmud, we have the discussion of the analysis of the Mishnah, the bring of tangential information, finding the source from the Torah itself, and as in any lecture, any other tangential material, whether it be philosophy or history, which somehow has bearing on the general discussion. So in any school of where the Torah was taught from the time of Moshe, basically until our times, we could describe this discussion, very much of the give and take and the analysis, as Talmud. The Talmud that was preserved, that what we call Talmud, was the discussions of the Mishnah that took place in Israel, and that's the Talmud Yerushalmi, and in Babylon, and this is the Talmud Bavli, in the period after the completion of our form of the Mishnah. The editor of our Mishnah was Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince. He died, what seems, in the year 192 of the Common Era. The Mishnah was composed before his death, sometime, and that we are not sure. From his death and on, of course, his Mishnah was discussed. Much of that discussion was recorded. And in the yeshivas in Israel, the recording of these discussions as they went on for some 200 years is what was preserved in the Talmud Yerushalmi. In Babylon, it went on for well over 100 years afterwards, and that was preserved in the Talmud Bavli. Now, with that introduction, I would like to go into the story of the subject of tonight's lecture, Rabbi Yochanan. We find in history certain individuals who spanned not just one or two generations, but multiple generations, who were able to convey the wisdom of relative ancients to the moderns. One prime example is Hillel. Hillel lived to be 120 years old. The last 40 years of his life were devoted to that position of Nossi, the head of the Sanhedrin, the head of the greatest conclave of Jewish scholars. And it would seem up until the time of his death, he was still active, he was still teaching, and he was handing over Torah that he had learned while he was still a young man. So in a sense, his youngest followers had a connection to a life 100 years before. It would be the equivalent of pretend on this lecture right now, somebody would, I'm not that old, but somebody would be standing here and describing the what occurred in the yeshivas in the 1880s or the 1890s. And the students here would now have that connection. If normally a student in yeshiva has a connection to what occurred perhaps in 1960, you know, at most. So you get the sense of having someone of that age, of that, who brings with him all that knowledge, so that we're brought that much closer. Another prime example is one of the most prestigious, or perhaps the most well-known of the disciples of Hillel, even though it seems that he was his disciple very late in Hillel's life, was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He too lived to be 120. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had a Talmud, had a disciple, again, one of the younger of his disciples. In actuality, he was a disciple of a disciple of his. And that was Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva also lived to be 120. The subject of tonight's lecture, Rabbi Yochanan, lived to be well over 100. And if you take a look, says on the back page here, I have a timeline. Many of these dates are approximate, some of them are exact, but it was important to create a timeline to give you a sense of structure of the flow of the history. Rabbi Yochanan, it seems, was born around the year 176. He died in the year 287. And virtually all of the Talmud Yerushalmi, at least the people, were people that either Rabbi Yochanan himself had met or Rabbi Yochanan had taught. It's the work of Rabbi Yochanan, his teachers, his contemporaries, his disciples. There's one generation that follows the death of Rabbi Yochanan's disciples that's recorded in the Talmud Yerushalmi. But if there's one man who left his imprint on the discussions that were recorded, it is Rabbi Yochanan. very unusual thing about Rabbi Yochanan is for most people, we discuss their histories, their stories, it starts from at least from birth. The story of Rabbi Yochanan really starts still while he was a fetus. Amazing story, and this is the first thing which is recorded on the first page here, the first paragraph. Rabbi Yochanan's mother, which is a very common occurrence that happens with dehydration, felt labor pains coming on Yom Kippur. The baby would have been born prematurely. The mother evidently was in the same place that Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, the famous Rabbi, the editor of the Mishnah. And he said to them, go and whisper to her. In other words, he told us, he was aware of the problem. He says, go and whisper to her, today is Yom Kippur. In other words, the fetus will hear this. They whispered to her, and the contraction stopped. And they took it as a sign there was a very special, baby awaiting to be born in that mother. This was Rabbi Yochanan. The Yerushalmi in Ksubas describes the unusual gift of memory that some of the teachers of the Talmud had. One of them is Rabbi Yochanan. Here it's in the second paragraph. He said, I recognize the woman who accompanied my mother at birth. Now that is, there are people who have good memories, but that is really something special. Unfortunately, this budding genius's life was severely affected, though, by events that occurred before and at his birth. His father died while his mother was still in pregnancy. His mother died at childbirth. So he was raised, seems, by his grandparents. And in fact, in paragraph D, we describe that he remembers the child. I was riding the shoulders of my grandfather as the voice of Rabbi Shimon ben Elozer. This was one of the contemporaries of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, a disciple of Rabbi Meir, who was sitting and teaching the following, and he remembered what was taught even though he was just a little child riding on his grandfather's shoulders. Another very fascinating aspect about Rabbi Yochanan, we discussed his memory. We discussed his innate spirituality. That it seems even while she was still a fetus, just saying it's Yom Kippur would calm the child. The Talmud, this is on page 2. Talmud records that his skin literally shined. It was ruddy red. It was shiny. It was beautiful. And in fact, it lists him as one of the most beautiful people of his time. The only thing that marred the beauty is in antiquity is up to 100 or 200 years where it was common for men to wear beards. It says Rabbi Yochanan did not have a beard. I mean, at least it didn't grow in a normal way of a beard. He didn't have a hadrosponim, the beauty that comes with a beard. But his skin was it seems, is phenomenal. There's and again, this is the last part of this section, which I'd like to sum up here. Rabbi Yochanan was also a gift with tremendous strength. And the story is they were going up a staircase, Rabbi Yochanan, and he was attended on both sides by his close disciples, Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, and the staircase collapsed. Where he was standing, though, he could still walk. So he literally carried his two disciples, one on one hand and one, and walked up the staircase or the ladder, bringing them all up. And they were wondering, says, you know, if you have that strength, what do you need us to support you while you walk? And he answered, you know, I have to preserve all this strength. What's going to be for my old age, you know? I don't want to strain myself here. But here we have a person that was granted unusual gifts. We find a parallel. There's a Gemara in the Dorim in Lamed Chesom, Lamed Chesom at Aleph, and this is in 38a, where it says that a prophet, one who was sent to be an influential person, a person to change the course of history, is often given certain attributes. One of them is the attribute of wisdom. Other, the attribute of strength. Because it's important for a leader to be respected not just for his Torah, not just because of the message, because but he has to be a prestigious person in his own right, so that the message that he will give will be naturally accepted. It seems that Rabbi Yochanan's phenomenal mind, his innate spirituality, we're going to speak about his humility, his strength, was something that made him a very attractive individual, and perhaps that's why he was granted these gifts. Because if he, of all people, put a stamp on that very important generation directly after the creation of the Mishnah. We discussed before that he had, just even being on his grandfather's shoulders, he picked up Torah. But at a young age, it seems that he sat, says before, says Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Yehuda the prince, and he became one of his smaller disciples, as we're going to see, but a disciple that Rabbi himself recognized was a person who was destined for greatness. And this is the first quote we have of the Gemara in Pesachim. You can look yourself. Describing those years that he was by Rabbi Yochanan, on the bottom of page 2. Rabbi Yochanan was describing to Reish Lakish, his colleague and his disciple, Rav. Rav was a topic of a previous lecture. And Reish Lakish asks, who is this Rav? He doesn't know who this person is. Rabbi Yochanan says, don't you remember him? He says, this was the person, says, who attended, says, the lectures of Rabbi, and there's the great rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and Rabbi Chia, his close colleague. He says, all the years during which the disciple sat before his teachers, I remained standing. In other words, there were rows of those who sat, and there were those behind them that stood. He was from those who were privileged to sit. I was young. I sat. I stood in the back. And in fact, on page 3, it describes that that Rav sat in the front row. He says, I was 17 rows behind. But even though he was young, it seems just the mere fact of seeing a person of that spiritual, the level of spirituality of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, had a tremendous effect on him. And on paragraph D, on page 3, Rabbi Yochanan and Shimon ben Lakish, his colleague, said, we merited to know Torah only because we saw the fingers of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi that protruded from his robes. In other words, it's hyperbole, but it means just seeing that person made such an impression on us. But those were in his earliest years. After the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, he continued to study at the feet of the great disciples of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And here in the bottom, page 3, we have Rabbi Yochanan says that I spent 18 days, at least originally, at the feet of Rabbi Yosha. Rabbi Yosha had 12 disciples, evidently very special people. He got to know them intimately. And it's also, says the it just gives you a picture of what life was like then. The Jews lived in terrible poverty. This was after the Jews had already been crushed at Betar. Some 70 years had passed. And just describing how it was, you know, if things are rough at the Kollel, this is what it was in the time of Rav Oishe here in the bottom of page 3. He says, when we're studying Torah at Rav Oishe's, four of us used to sit in the space of one cubit. In other words, it says, Yosh Arba, it says Arba Ba'ama. In other words, I mean, they were just so, again, maybe it's hyperbola, but they were just so tightly pressed. And all he had was 12 disciples. So they just had a little room. I mean, basically, he says, they just had a little room, and that's where he taught Torah. But even when Rabbi Yochanan had already become a Rosh Yeshiva and had his own yeshiva, he kept on visiting Rabbi Oishe, even though, says he didn't need his basic knowledge, but he wanted to honor Rabbi Oishe, and of course, in the process to being close to such a person, to pick up this bit of information, that bit of information, and they kept close. So here we find, again, I just wanted to just summarize what the picture we have. We have Rabbi Yochanan, gifted from youth, having in his early days studied by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, continuing on Rabbi Oishe, and even in his later years, continuing on that contact. As I say, he was a very humble person, Rabbi Yochanan. He also studied from Rabbi Hanina. Both Rabbi Oishe and Rabbi Hanina were subject of a previous lecture. Rabbi Hanina, and this is an amazing story, here on page 4, paragraph B. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, let me just give you some background. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi lived in the city of Tzipori. He moved there, and he was there in the last 17 years of his life. In the continuing years, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's children and grandchildren were all in Tzipori. They led the Sanhedrin, this conclave of Jewish scholars, and therefore all the students basically came to Tzipori. Rabbi Hanina was also in Tzipori. Sepphoris is the English version of the name of Tzipori. And he saw, says Rabbi Hanina, was walking in the streets of Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba after the death of Rabbi Hanina, went to study also by Rabbi Yochanan. So he was walking the streets. Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba was supporting him, and he saw everyone was running. And Rabbi Hanina asked him, "Where are the people running?" And he says, "Rabbi Yochanan is sitting expounding in the study hall of Benaya, and all the people are running to listen to him." In other words, Rabbi Yochanan was not an official Rosh Yeshiva yet; he didn't have his own yeshiva, but people recognized him. Rabbi Hanina said, "Ah, blessed is the merciful one that was able to see them all running to him while I'm still alive. I taught him all of the Agadata." The Agadata is the moral and ethical and philosophical explanation of Scripture. So with the exception of Mishle and Koheles. There's 24 books of Scripture. I taught him the exposition of 22 of them. And I feel so good that in my lifetime I was able to see my student reach to such heights and able to make that kind of a contribution. Rabbi Yochanan in turn had very strong feelings towards Rabbi Hanina, and when he died, this is the end of paragraph, this is the second paragraph in section B, he rent 13 robes of precious itzel milson, of a Milesian wool, of precious wool, at different times, the Gemara Moed Kotn explains that when he would just think of Rabbi Hanina, he would mention him, and he would cry, he would feel the loss. And he says, "Ozla gavra de mastafina mine, gone is the man before him whom I trembled." Because whenever I'd say something, I think, what is he going to say about this? Because he always kept me in line. He was always someone that I know, someone higher than me that existed. And now I'm on my own, like I'm orphaned. He studied under Rabbi Hanina, he studied under Rabbi Yanai, he studied under Chizkiah. This is Rabbi Chiya's son. As we just from the citations, and these are just only a few of the many citations, I just want to bring out, he is a person that he's not just a self-made man. The essence of the Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral law, is Mesorah. It's handed down. It isn't newly created. This is why Ovos, in Pirkei Ovos, begins Moshe Kibbol Torah Misinai, he received it at Sinai, Mesorah LeYeshua, gave it over to Joshua, Yeshua LeZakenim. It was handed down. Rabbi Yochanan was a teacher of Talmud, but at the same time was a student. And his contribution are not only his own, but a perpetuation of a long line. Every one of us, in different ways, are challenged. We're going to deal with other challenges in the life of Rabbi Yochanan. But a particular challenge is that of poverty. And it's interesting to note, in pre-World War II Europe, despite the fact that there were millions and millions of practicing Jews, there were relatively very few students in yeshivas. And a major cause was the tremendous poverty that existed in Eastern Europe. It's very difficult to send your child to yeshiva. He has nothing to eat. And even those who went to yeshivas did it under tremendous privation. There were very few yeshivas that had true dormitories and kitchen facilities. They had to... There were townspeople who volunteered to feed, you know, the students, one on this day and one on another day. It was called Es and Teg. They used to eat day by day. It's very difficult. And it could be understood, the pressures on parents who didn't want to subject their children to such conditions. Rabbi Yochanan, it seems, also lived a life of poverty. As we said, he was orphaned. But it also seems that his parents left him a Yerusha, left him an inheritance. But all that he had, he gave up to continue on his studies of Torah. And this is, we have on page 5, Years of Hardship. And describes, as in beautiful terms, how Rabbi Yochanan was walking from Tiberias to Sepphori, with the support of Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba. He was the one who supported Rabbi Hanina before. And they reached a certain field, and Rabbi Yochanan said, you know, you see this field? So this field used to belong to me, but I sold it so I'll be able to learn Torah. They reached a certain vineyard. He says, you know, this thing also belonged to me, but I sold it. And they came to an olive orchard. He says, I sold it. Rabbi Chiya says, you know, he started to cry. I said, what are you crying for? He says, you didn't leave anything for your old age. He says, you have nothing left. And Rabbi Yochanan replies, says, Chiya, my son, says, is it considered insignificant in your eyes that I forsook something that was given in 6 days? In other words, the world was created, according to the Torah, in 6 days in order to acquire something that was given in 40 days. As the Torah was given, Moshe was on the mountain for 40 days. In other words, it was just a poetic way of saying that I think I made a better deal of this. And when Rabbi Yochanan died, his generation paraphrased the following verse in Shir HaShirim. In Shir HaShirim it says, a person would be, this is in the story of the love story, he says the thing about the love one had for the other, he says that if they would give, you know, for that love, you know, he says, to take away, he says, his beloved, says, I'd give you all of this wealth He licks nothing. To give up such a beloved, and this is, you know, in the Shira Shirman, a love story. Of course, it's a mushal, it's a parable about the love of God to the Jewish people. They used it as a pair, they paraphrased it in the love, says, that Rabbi Yochanan had towards the Torah. If a man would give all the wealth of his house to entice one away from the love with which Rabbi Yochanan loved the Torah, would be utterly scorned. The love that he had was so that really nothing stood in its way. And it seems to me it's quite important. Here we have a Rabbi Yochanan again, a transitional figure, someone who transferred the Torah of the previous generations to the new generation, a person who lived for 111 years. And he lived in a time of great difficulty. It's great political difficulty. It was tremendous. I didn't quote him again. This is because of brevity, I can't quote every Gemara that speaks to Rabbi Yochanan. But there's a quote from a Gemara in Bava Basra. Rabbi Yochanan remembers speaking about the famine that existed in his day. I think it's Tzadik Aleph Amud Beis, 91b. The people were dying of hunger. He says they had they didn't have money to buy food. They were just, it was just so terrible as in his youth. And it was important for a leader of Jewry and all the students know, here's a person who sacrificed. It would be a source of inspiration for them to continue on. You know, how could they, you know, leave learning, you know, for this financial consideration or that, says, when their own Rebbe says sacrifice so much, and look what became of him. And in this context, we can understand here, at the beginning of page 6, there's a quote from the Gemara in Tainus, in Chof Aleph Amud Aleph in 21a. Amazing story. Ilfa and Rabbi Yochanan, and Ilfa is also one of the great teachers of the Talmud. Of course, his teachings are not as widespread as Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was the Rosh Yeshiva. But in their youth, they studied Torah together and found themselves in great want. And they said, you know what? It's just terrible here. I mean, we just can't continue like this. You know, it was a common saying, you know, there were yeshiva bachurim in Europe that fasted Monday and Thursdays. And they said, you know, it's a miracle we fasted because we'd starve to, otherwise we'd starve to death. He says, you know, we got to do something. So they went down, and they were leaving. They left the yeshiva. I don't know if there was too much for them to pack up, but they left, and they walked down the road. And they went, and they sat down for a moment under a wall that, you know, was part of a ruin. And the wall itself was not, structurally was not sound. And they were eating. They heard, or Rabbi Yochanan heard, two angels, this is how the Talmud brings it, speaking one to the other, and he says, let's throw this wall upon these people, because they forsook eternal life. He says, Chai Olam, just to be involved in temporal life. Like for them, it was more important to achieve financial success and not spiritual success. The other angel says, you know, leave them alone, because one is destined for greatness. Rabbi Yochanan heard this. According to the Talmud, Ilfa did not. And Rabbi Yochanan said, did you hear anything? He said, no. So I figured, if I heard it, must be I'm the man. So Rabbi Yochanan says, you know what? I decided to go back. You know, it says the poor will never cease from the earth. I'll be one of those. Rabbi Yochanan went back. Ilfa went on to a career in business. When Ilfa came back, notice he had... evidently, he had made enough that he felt now he'd be comfortable to continue on learning. Rabbi Yochanan already was the Rosh Yeshiva. I painted a picture of Rabbi Yochanan. We're going to get back to Rabbi Yochanan a little later. I'd like to now to paint a picture of the historic background. We mentioned before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince. I'd like you to turn to the back page here with the timeline. During the time of the temple, the Sanhedrin, the supreme body of Torah scholars, acted not only as authorities of Torah, but also they acted in the capacity as the chief, as chief justices of the Supreme Court. And ultimately, this was the highest actual court, where they meted out sentences of death. Shortly before the destruction of the temple, that function of the Sanhedrin was taken away from them. They could only deal, this is discussed in the previous lecture, they could only mete out capital punishment while they were part of the temple complex. And when they left, and they left to go on a place on the Temple Mount, not only were they incapable of meting out capital punishment, but no court in Israel was capable of dealing with capital crimes. And from that time on, this is some 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the Sanhedrin moved in the capacity of outside of the temple itself. They were the ultimate yeshiva. This was the greatest conclave of Torah scholars. They moved to a place called Chonos. They moved into the city of Jerusalem. They moved to Yavne. They moved to Usha. They used to Shvarom, Beis Shorim. In the time of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, it moved to Tzipori. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the prince. He presided over the Sanhedrin. When he died, Rabbi Gamliel was the head. You know, if you just look at the timeline, the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is in the year 192. His son Rabbi Gamliel, who was Gamliel III, took over. We're not sure how long he reigned. It was not for a long time. We just approximately from the year 202, he died. And in turn, his son, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, called Rabbi Yehuda Nisiyah, in Aramaic, reigned. It was in his reign that Rav, the founder of the one of the major yeshivas in Babylon, moved to Babylon. In his time in Babylon itself, there was a major change, which we're going to speak of in subsequent lectures. And in the year 230, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Nasiya, died. So this was, if we go from the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, it's approximately 42 years. During this whole period, the Sanhedrin was exactly as it was before. These were all descendants. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Gamliel, were all descendants of the famous Hillel. They were the supreme halachic authority, and as they presided over the Sanhedrin, and they were also, in a certain sense, a political authority. They were called the Nasi, the prince. But to have this dual role, both a political role and the teaching role, one has to be of that person, of that stature. And it seems that after the death of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi II, the descendants were no longer in that league. They were not capable of being both the political heads of sorts and the spiritual head. And we find a splitting, a parting of the ways, where the Nisiyim, the president, they're called now princes, still remained in Tzipori. But Rabbi Yochanan moved to Tveria, founded a yeshiva, and this with the equivalent of the Sanhedrin would be the conclave, the supreme conclave. Those authorities of Torah no longer were with the Nasi, were no longer with the prince. We have really two separate functions: the function of Rosh Yeshiva now, and of Nasi. It didn't exist before. The Nasi, the prince, was the Rosh Yeshiva, was the head of the yeshiva. Now we have this split. And if any one event, we'll just say the break between the period of the Mishnah and the period of the Talmud, is this event. one can understand that the descendants of Hillel would resist this change. I mean, after all, they're Zaydas. I mean, it's like a Chassidish Rebbe, you know what I mean? His Zayda and his Zayda's Zayda led all these throngs of people. And now you're saying, I'm not worthy of this? And it's fascinating to find how this was recorded in the Talmud itself. Again, just in the timeline, Rabbi Yehuda says, this, the one who died in the year 230 was one who commanded universal respect amongst all the students of the disciples of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the one who died in the year 192. After his death, we look at the treatment. We find in Talmudic sources the treatment of descendants are treated, they treat them as inferiors. And in the life now, we get the year 232, in the year of Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, the third, who according to this would have been a very young man. We find fascinating stories recorded in the Talmud Yerushalmi. Here on this page 6. Rabbi Yanai, this is on paragraph A, Rabbi Yanai and Rabbi Yochanan were sitting as Rabbi Yehuda the third, in other words, a patriarch, entered. And he asked them a question in Jewish law. They gave an answer. He challenged them. And they felt he challenged them as an equal. And really, he was their inferior. In other words, he wanted to maintain the position of what his grandparents had maintained. To his grandparents, all the other scholars were just treated as if they were disciples. They were his inferiors. But with this, says Rabbi Yochanan, said to Rabbi Yanai, Rabbi Yanai was a teacher, Rabbi Yochanan says, you know, let's get out of here. He says, let's depart. He says, this man doesn't want to hear the words of Torah. He gave an explanation, and the way, the tone of how it was challenged was not of a student who wants to know, but really as a peer who's challenging. He says, you're not a peer. You're a nobody. And you have to know your place. Because if you want to know, it says, you know, ask, as a disciple asks. And they got up to leave. At least the title of Nasi, you know, this is a title that was of long standing. Yet they looked at him via angle, you know, I mean, it's... In another incident which we record in the bottom of page 6, Rabbi Yochanan went to visit Rabbi Yehuda III. And again, he treated him with respect after all, let's see. It was a great-great-grandson of his Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, a grandson of Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, who was the last person of who commanded universal respect. And he came out to him in a linen tunic. And he said, you know, he told him, Rabbi Yochanan at this time was in his mid-50s. We don't know how old this Rabbi Yehuda, this Rabbi Nasiya III, maybe he was a very young man, perhaps just a young adult, an adolescent. And he told him, says, you know, you should dress the part. Says, you know, says, you're the Nasi already, you should play the part of royalty. And again, says, when he was about to leave, he asked him for advice, and it seems the tone that he asked him, again, was that of a peer, or of a superior. And he told him, listen here, if you want advice, go to that person, you know. Says, you have to learn. He says, I'm not just a, you know, I'm not your buddy. And he ended off, Torah's chesed al lashono, says, a person who studies Torah has to know to speak with derech eretz. You know, you have to speak with the proper decorum. You have to know how to deal with your superiors. And it would seem that it was a very difficult transition. And eventually Rabbi Yochanan left to Tveria, founded the yeshiva. But it would seem that over time, this Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya realized his position and treated Rabbi Yochanan as his teacher and quotes him. Was at a later generation after Rabbi Yochanan had already passed away. He told us, this is what Rabbi Yochanan used to teach us. It seems he used Rabbi Yochanan, evidently again, it seems the earlier period of transition was very difficult. But afterwards, they were very close, and it describes a situation where, again, which is an important historical note, that the Nossi had his own army or police force, and he used it on occasion. They were so close, and this is the end of this section here. They were so close that it seems, we know Rabbi Yochanan's early years were of poverty. They actually supported Rabbi Yochanan. And where the Gemara brings, there's a Gemara in Sota, Chof Aleph Amud Aleph, from 21a, quote on page 7, paragraph E. Says the we know of famous partnerships. You know, like the famous partnership of Yisachar and Zvulun, where the two partners, one supported the other. They both reaped the financial riches and spiritual riches. That arrangement occurred with Rabbi Yochanan in the house of the Nasi. So we find, in other words, it seems the beginning was rough going in the beginning, but things evidently straightened out over time. As we said before, Rabbi Yochanan says left for Tveria. I guess time doesn't. You can look at the notes. What the reasoning? What prompted him? But it seems there was a person who Rabbi Yochanan looked at as a person not worthy of leadership. And these are the two quotes here. This is Rabbi Chanina, and it seems Rabbi Chanina Bar Sisi, who ruled in Sipori, says, in a way that Rabbi Yochanan himself felt, and he had a position of leadership, and he felt that he just can't be together with him. And he left, and he created his own. And it's really from there, as we said, the whole Talmud Yerushalmi came out from that yeshiva. Again, you could look at this, we offer the notes, as we find that Rabbi Yochanan founded the yeshiva. There is a tradition which is quoted of Shrira Gaon. It says he was a Rosh Yeshiva for 80 years, approximately 80 years. The historian of Isaac HaLevi wants to amend that. He says that it's a scribal error, and it was approximately 60 years. Exact, it was about 55 years. And he found, says there's a page in the beginning of page 9, according to his interpretation, it seems that Rabbi Yochanan taught the Talmud in two cycles. The cycle, as it was known, at least in Babylonian times, in times of the Talmud and later times, was a 30-year cycle. And this is something we're going to discuss in subsequent lectures, but let me just touch upon it right now. The Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's Mishnah, consists of six orders and approximately 60 Masechtas. It's a question of 61 or 63, but it's approximately 60 tractates, Masechtos, which are in six orders, like 10 to an order. In the yeshivas in Babylon, in Talmudic times and in the times of the Gaonim, they studied jointly one tractate per semester. A semester was 5 months with 1 month of intercession. So that over a period of 30 years, approximately, you covered all of the Talmud. Rav Ashi, the final editor, major editor of the Talmud, completed almost two complete cycles. It seems, and this is how Rav Isaac HaLevi learns this passage in the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan completed almost two complete cycles. He was the Rosh Yeshiva for 55 years. And again, Rabbi Yochanan, in terms of disciples, and we're going to go at greater length in subsequent lectures, I just quoted, and you could look at it yourself. He has his colleague who he calls one of equal standing, Reish Lakish. This is all in the yeshiva in Tveria. He had Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar, again, who was Rosh Yeshiva after Rabbi Yochanan, who treated him with the greatest, as we said, with the greatest respect. He would stay standing, Rabbi Yochanan would leave until Rabbi Yochanan would be totally out of out of sight. And when he would leave the presence of Rabbi Yochanan, he would walk backwards, you know, until again he would be out of sight. Say, he touched his great disciples, and we're going to go in lengths in subsequent lectures. Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Rabbi Abohu, Rabbi Asi, this is Rabbi Abba. Many of them came from Babylon to sit at his feet. Many were originally from Israel. So again, let me just summarize what we have, and then we're going to go a little to touch the intimate life of Rabbi Yochanan. We went over the backdrop of the history of the change of the yeshivas. Originally, the Nossi was the head of the, was not only political head, but the Supreme Torah authority. That changed when Rabbi Yochanan made his yeshiva. Rabbi Yochanan himself, was a very gifted child, lived with as an orphan, had to overcome much poverty, but was a person that had much to bring to the new generation. He had studied at the feet of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi's disciples, and in turn taught a whole generations of new disciples who came to him from Israel and Babylon. We discussed his hardships in terms of the poverty. It's fascinating, these stories about basically his own sicknesses as well. Here on page 11, just in this story, and there's much to be learned from this account. Rabbi Yochanan suffered for 3.5 years from stones. I mean, it seems it's not clear what in kidney stones. Rabbi Hanina came to visit him. Rabbi Hanina was quoted before. Rabbi Hanina was one of the great disciples of Yehuda Hanossi. He had studied under Rabbi Hanina. Rabbi Hanina asked, "What's bothering you?" He says, "You know, I have more suffering than I can bear." And the first Rabbi Hanina says, "You know, you shouldn't speak that way. If you have problems," says, "I trust in God, you know, the faithful God, Hashem will take care of me." So from then on, whenever he'd be gripped by the pain, it could be extremely painful, either from the stones of the gallbladder or the kidney, so as it would grip him, he would say, "The faithful God." And he would, but there was a time that it was just so unbearable that even if he would, even attitudinal changes wouldn't change the way he could bear the suffering. Rabbi Hanina visited him again, and he said a prayer. He said something, and it went away, and he was healed. Rabbi Hanina himself became ill at a later date. Rabbi Yochanan came to visit Rabbi Hanina, his Rebbe. And he asked, Rabbi Hanina says, "Well, yes, what's bothering you?" And he says, "You know, it's very difficult." He says, "But look at the great reward of suffering, because suffering is a great challenge. A person in suffering can still maintain his faith, can still trust in God. A person can rise phenomenally spiritually in such a situation." He says, "You know," says, "it's too much for me. I don't want them nor their reward." It's showing genug. So he says, "But you said, why don't, you know, you help me out? Why don't you say something that should go away? You know, you did it for me." He says, "When I was on the outside, you know, I was able to be guarantor for others. When I'm on the inside, I need help." The language of the Talmud is "Ein chavush mater atzma beis asurim." Someone in prison can't get himself out. You need help from the outside. If there was one particular aspect of his personality that one would learn from, or that he would say this was the message that he taught, it was humility. And on page 12, we have various sources where he describes how the humility of God himself, that there's nothing beneath the dignity of God. He points out wherever in Scripture it describes the loftiness of God, very often next to it, he just says he does justice for the fatherless and the widow. Says he's involved in lowering himself. Says he doesn't stay aloof. Basically, the message, of course, for us is the same. He described paragraph B, so we have the quote from the Gemara in Sota, that someone who's haughty, who's arrogant, is equivalent to someone who worships idols. And describing this is about how one could merit being a great scholar in Torah. He says Torah is not found among the arrogant. Even he treated, I think this is just a fascinating thing, the Talmud Yerushalmi says he treated his slaves, and we know about the slaves, how they're treated in antiquity. He treated his slaves as they would be his peers. He would give them the same thing that he himself would eat. And we know from Roman sources that slaves normally ate very poorly. And he said, he quoted the Pasuk in Iyov, says, you know, the same God made both of us. Why should I treat my slave any worse than I treat myself? There's a fascinating story, which perhaps will just give a better understanding of Rabbi Yochanan, and perhaps the whole idea of humility. And I'll end off the lecture with this story. But before that, I just want to say on page 13, Rabbi Yochanan lived to be over 110. He died after the death of Reish Lakish, which we're going to speak at length in the next lecture. He was so distraught by the fact that his colleague Reish Lakish had gone. A person that didn't just approve of his statements, but really challenged him. It says whenever he would give a lecture, make a point, says Reish Lakish would offer 24 objections, and he was so distraught that he'd lost, like he felt totally that he became insane, he became deranged. Like the loss of just his mind. And the rabbis prayed that he should die. Is it better that he couldn't? You know, there was a question that was asked, why didn't the rabbis pray that he should become sane again? And the answer is, yeah, but if he would become sane again, it would just recur again, because he would start teaching, and again he'd remember how Reish Lakish would challenge him, and he'd feel all alone, and again he would fall into the same depression. So he says, it would be best that he died. But it's evident that he was so involved in the teaching, even though he was an elderly person already, that they described his death like the setting of the sun in midday. This is on 13, paragraph B. He was a. It was still such a shock, because he was still, despite his years, he was so involved in learning. And finally, here in the quote, this is the Gemara in Bava Metzia, is Rabbi Zeira, one of his great disciples, the subject of a subsequent lecture, describes that Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, who had died, appeared to Rabbi Zeira in a dream, and he says, "How is it in the Heavenly Academy?" His Rabbi Yochanan is near his Rebbe, Rabbi Yanai. Rabbi Yanai is near Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Chanina is near Rabbi Chia. Rabbi Chia evidently has the highest place. Rabbi Chia was one of the greatest disciples of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. But his greatness lied not only in his own spiritual, intellectual heights, but he was very much involved in teaching little children Torah. This is a subject, we discussed this before. In fact, and again, this is a period of great poverty, and there was a lack of teachers. He went and taught little kids Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the five books of Moses. He taught the Mishnah. He made sure on his own the Torah would not be forgotten. And it's for that reason he has such a lofty place. in a community, very often we look as those who teach on an elementary level don't receive the same status as those who teach on a much higher advanced level. Because Rabbi Chiya's great place was because he taught on the most basic level. Because the elementary teachers are those who are the foundation of our continuity. I'd like to end off with the following story. One of the great scholars in the early 19th century was Rabbi Akiva Eger. Rabbi Akiva Eger had a son, Rabbi Shlomo Eger. Rabbi Shlomo Eger's son, Rabbi Leibola Eger, became a chassid. And the way his father, Rabbi Shlomo Eger, took his leaving, because of the fold, would be the best described as if in the 60s if a child went off and became a hippie, you know, left and went on to a commune. He looked at the same, he was with the same horror. And they say Rav Shlomo Eger sat Shiva, you know, which would be equivalent to someone who leaves the faith. He sat Shiva on his son who became a chassid. The story goes that he sent someone to where his Shlomo Eger sent a spy, and to Kotsk, the city where his son had left, had gone to the Kotsk, the famed Kotsk Rebbe, to see what was it, what is it that attracted his son, like that he left would be what he considered normative Judaism to take this very what he looks as a very strange road. And I want to tell you this story comes from this spy. Amongst the things that he saw in Kotsk, the spy told over the story of going into an inn. It was a village inn owned by a Jew. And he sat by a table, and he saw there were three Hasidim sitting at an adjoining table in a discussion. In the midst of the discussion, a fourth chassid walks into the room. With this, the three all stand up. Rav Moshe, you know, they treat Rav Moshe with the greatest respect. And they remain standing until Rav Moshe leaves the room. His curiosity was piqued, and the spy went over to the three chassidim and asked, "Who is this Rav Moshe? Where is the Rav Moshe? Is he a man of learning? Is he a Tom? Ah, come. He just knows how to daven and say tillim. He knows to say psalms. He's not a scholar. Is he a person of a prestigious family? Is he miyuchas? Comes from very humble beginnings. Is he a man of wealth, perhaps? Is he a great philanthropist? Doesn't have two nickels to rub together. So what is it? What's his greatness? What is it that you see that you're standing up for him?" He says, "He's humble." See, he couldn't understand this. A little later, the spy had an audience with the Kotzke Rebbe. And he described the story, same detail I told you. And the spy says, "I can't understand this." Says, "That's what they stand up for. He's humble. You know, like, the Kotzker looked at him. Says, "You don't understand. Says, look what you told me. He's a man who has no money. He has no education. He has no family. And yet he still remains humble. That's a feat. It's something that we tend to compensate. That's part of our nature, that we tend to compensate for our failings. And very often you find people have the least to show for their lives, have the greatest amount of arrogance. That's part of a defense mechanism we have. And yet that person still remained humble. Ah, das ja Kunst, you know, that's really something noteworthy." It may be true from a Hasidic point of view. I mean, there's a lot of truth to it. On the other hand, though, when we have a person who is so gifted and so well recognized, and yet still remains humble, very often it's even a greater, it's even more noteworthy. When people are the subject of adulation and yet still know their limits, still retain their humility. And it would seem that in Rabbi Yochanan, we have an, which I didn't quote, says, he held himself, as we said, 13 years he went to Raboishia. He always praised his students. He was the embodiment of humility. And perhaps that's why he felt in himself is the importance to give his disciples, despite that they were disciples, they were the future leaders of Jewry, they should maintain that humility. Humility is a something that not only is it's important for the person himself, it's important in terms of how you impact on others. The Gemara in the Dorm, which we quoted previously in the beginning of the lecture, that a prophet, you know, that a prophet was, that Hashem created the circumstances that the prophets were people of wealth, people of strength, people of wisdom, people that they were naturally respected. They're also people that had humility. People love humble people. They shy away from those that are arrogant. It could very well be that Rabbi Yochanan was speaking to the future leaders of the Jewish people. He says, you should keep in mind, God is humble. God detests those that are arrogant. It's of utmost importance for you, the future leaders of Israel, to have that godly attribute of humility. Okay, are there any questions? What? Not. It takes just an insight, you know. But it'll be ready. So. Yeah. No questions? Right, there was just nobody. You have to realize Rabbi Yochanan was 110. Reish Lakish was almost his age. They had both seen Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. They were of a different generation. There was just nobody on that level. He had no. Rabbi Yochanan was speaking about, you know, who cried in the death of Reish Lakish, and had really no companions left. You know, it's similar to the story of Choni Amagel, you know, who coming to the study hall, he was unrecognized, and he prayed to God that he die. Says oichav rusay mesusa, you know, or friendship or death, and it was like that kind of a thing. He had nobody in his generation anymore, and he had no one to grow. You know, and he had no one to grow from.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.